G2V Productions is your portal to pop culture. Fan of The Walking Dead, Z Nation, or zombie movies? Make an appointment with the Doctor of the Dead, featuring world-renowned zombie expert Dr. Arnold T. Blumberg. Follow him on Twitter, at Doctor of the Dead. Doctor Who fan? Then step into the vortex with two published and produced Doctor Who experts, at Who's Talking Cast. And for movies, comics, TV shows, games, toys, and more, the G2V Podcast, the official podcast of G2V Productions, is your pop culture magazine for everything under the sun. At G2V Podcast. That's the G2V Productions lineup, available on iTunes at itunes.com/G2V. And visit the official website for shows, articles, and links at g2vpodcast.com.
This is author Paul O'Brien here from Blood Red Turns Daughter Green and paulobrien.info. You're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Well, hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener. And welcome to episode 27 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things you can find on iTunes or your podcast app. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that's attempting to find the culture in pop culture. Myself, along with just a whole plethora of great podcasts, can be found at chronicrift.com. I want to thank everybody for tweeting, downloading, listening to all the podcasts we've done this year. Traffic has been absolutely great. I know it's been a little bit more than a week or so since my last show. Had to do some screenwriting, face some deadlines, but we are back with a slew of really interesting, fascinating industry professionals and some independent filmmakers making some exciting projects, including one tonight. The fellow I'm about to interview, I met in 2013 at the Austin Film Festival. His resume, he's an award-winning screenwriter. He's an award-winning filmmaker. He's also directed some commercials and has been teaching about the world of screenwriting and filmmaking when he's somehow found time to do that. He has just launched an just incredibly fascinating kickstarting campaign that I'm just so happy to endorse and get behind. He'll be able to give it do it justice more than I can. But welcome to the Handsome Timmy D Express, John Matthews.
Thanks, Tim. Glad to be on.
Okay, so I'm looking at the Kickstarter page now. The link is below for those of you who want to follow along. This is so amazing. Psalms, the making of an album. Cultures and musical styles collide in this making of the album documentary. Jewish Appalachians plus Jewish Ugandans equal music history. How in the world did you find this? This is amazing.
well, I've found it through my composer initially. Ernest Azantovich went over to Uganda a couple of years ago and made an album with the Jewish Ugandans in this village called Puti, and it's really fascinating if you don't know about like how that there are this tribe of Abiudai Jews, and how they came about is like the turn of the century, there were some Christian missionaries that went to Uganda, and while they were there, they brought Bibles, and after they left, this group of native Ugandans there kind of took out their own kind of Torah, like they adopted kind of the books of Moses and made their own kind of hybrid form of Orthodox Judaism, and it survived like decades and decades of persecution from Idi Amin on. And it's still around today, about 2,000 of them in this village called Puti that's about 4 to 10 hours, depending on traffic and what kind of animals are in the road, east of Kampala in Uganda. And kind of how I got involved with it, Tim, is my composer went over there and made an album with them, and He showed me the music that he made, and it was just like, I mean, I just thought it was incredible. It's like this mix of like, you know, traditional Uganda music, like Paul Simon's Graceland kind of sound,
sure,
with like,
sure.
You know, traditional Hebrew music. So I was just like blown away by this, and he had all this footage that he shot while I was over there, and he was like, "Do you want to do something with this?" And I thought, I definitely, I want to do something, but I don't know what it is. And I didn't want to make, even as fascinating as it was, I didn't want to make some kind of like Wikipedia entry about the country or about the tribe. I wanted to make something character driven, like some kind of story. I kind of was thinking about it when I went to West Virginia and I met a rabbi down there by the name of James Cone. And James got me thinking about like Jewish Appalachians and how like that's kind of an interesting subculture. Just like, you know, you don't hear Jewish Ugandans in the same word, just in the same sentence, just like you don't hear Jewish Appalachians. So like I was thinking, what if we got like groups of musicians from both groups and combined them and had them make an album together and make and film them and make a making of the album documentary. I love those anyway. I love making of the albums documentaries. And like, what would that sound like? And what would that, you know, if we, the more, you know, what would that say about identity and what it means to be Jewish and what it means to us as humans to kind of like know who we are and where we're from and all those kind of like really specific questions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's funny because a lot of times the best documentaries are actually not that. You know, there's a lot of exposés and political stuff from various viewpoints, but it is that sort of collision of things or that juxtaposition of let's take this and put it in that and just sort of see what happens. And it's an amazing thing. Now, you're originally from West Virginia, if I remember correctly, right?
That's correct, yeah. I'm from southern West Virginia.
And it's funny, you just touched upon this. People don't really think of southern West Virginia as having or being packed with any kind of Jewish population. And that speaks to sort of our own prejudices and sort of the way we like to generalize and compartmentalize things. And both of these groups of people are breaking those generalizations.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think like, you know, part of Jewish culture, you know, part of what makes it what it is that it's spread out all over the world. And, you know, that includes, you know, not only the big cities and, you know, the Woody Allens and the, you know, the Jewish people that live in skyscrapers, but also the ones that live in the hollers of West Virginia, right. You know, and have accents like I do, you know, like that they're spread all over the world. And they're also, you know, spread, you know, in ways that like, in such a way that people have different views of what it means to be Jewish. Like, you know, and some people might think that means, you know, like an ethnic thing. My mom was Jewish or my dad was Jewish or I grew up in synagogue or maybe like, you know, I practice it, but I grew up that way, but I'm atheist, or it's a family thing, or it's you know, everybody has kind of a different answer to that question. Everybody I ask, and you know, and then of course you go to Uganda and, you know, they just kind of adopted their own form of Judaism and are more Orthodox than many who claim to be Jewish over here in the States. So, I mean, I think like the more specific we get at the question of like what it means to be Jewish, the more universal that will be to like what it means to us as humans to need to know who we are and where we're from. And, you know, like kind of that answer to the question of like, why do we have to spend, you know, why is it important to us to know? Like, why do we spend like hundreds of dollars to see if we're 1/16th Cherokee? Or like, you know, why do we spend all this money on Ancestry.com every year? Like, but it's important. It's important to us as humans to like know, you know, our identity.
And even if you're not Jewish, like somebody could watch this documentary, if they're Catholic, let's say, or Muslim, like what would it be like to meet, like this will inspire, I imagine, a lot of thoughts of what would it be like to meet a person who's of a similar faith across the world? Is it going to be a mirror or is it going to be a window? I mean, is it going to be a little bit of both? You know, so there is sort of a universality to this thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I hope people can watch this, you know, that aren't Jewish. I'm not Jewish, and I'm, you know, I'm learning a lot about it. I've even You know, like when I first started this, I had to read like Judaism for Dummies.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it was that at that kind of level. But what fascinates me about it is that it's not like this, you know, this film and this album and this kind of concept is not like, you know, so specific that only like the niche like Jewish audience would be interested in it. I mean, I'm interested in it because like I'm really interested in the concept of identity. And, you know, I think like the more specific we get to that, the more universal it'll be to a Muslim, to, you know, someone who's of any kind of religion or from any kind of place and uses all of this different components and why we use all those different components to make us up to call ourselves what we do and to decide what makes us who we are.
Yeah, and I want to say just real quick, at the risk of being overly PC, I kind of said, and even if you're Muslim, I kind of just meant with that because unfortunately in our today's climate, that religion is sometimes a bit too vilified, and I certainly don't feel that way. I have Muslim friends and Islamic friends who are not trying to blow anybody up and are just as nice and decent and normal as everybody else. So I just want to throw that out there that that may have come off a little bit wrong, and my apologies, because this is the reason why I love this project is it is finding that commonality and that normalcy of it. Now, the little nuts and bolts about the Kickstarter, you guys are making both the movie and the album. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the film is a making of the album documentary. So, I mean, I just think of like some of the great making of the album docs, like the Wilco, You're Trying to Break My Heart, or like, you know, the newer one that Sam Jones just did on the Bob Dylan Basement Tapes band that was put together, and you know just how those are kind of a container in and of themselves, that you kind of bring this group of musicians together and there's a beginning, middle, and end built in. They come together, they make an album, and they succeed or fail, and those I think are interesting in themselves with that container. But then you take like the fish out of water story of the West Virginians, the Appalachians going over to Uganda, and you know that in itself is a story. But then they've got this challenge of trying to make an album with like, you know, all these different kind of musical backgrounds and styles. And I mean, in Uganda, like, you know, it's there's a different way of thinking about music. I mean, they wouldn't call a minor key the same that we would call a minor key, and people have different ways of talking about it and terminology for it. And it's just going to be a really interesting challenge for both groups to see if they can kind of meld their styles and languages together to come up with something. And then our goal is, after we make this, I mean, if it turns out to be something cool, which we think it might, to bring the Ugandans back to West Virginia. And there's a NPR program called Mountain Stage that's out of Charleston. And we want to bring the Ugandans back and have them perform with the West Virginians on Mountain Stage.
Man, you don't do anything half measures. Because there's also going to be like just basic language differences.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, and not just like accents. And you talked about the different traditional stuff. Now, have you guys, and if you can't say yet, saving it from the movie, no worries, but like, has there been any discussions as sort of like, you know, are like the Appalachians going to bring five songs and the Ugandan brings five songs, or are they just going to come together, write music together, or is this going to be like traditional stuff they're going to collaborate on?
I think it's going to be a little bit of both. Okay. I think there'll be some traditional things that they'll collaborate on. They're kind of like, you know, it could be a song that the West Virginians grew up singing in synagogue, and that the Ugandans share as well. And then I hope that there's also like, hey, let's try this, and we've got some strong kind of musical leaders on both sides, from the West Virginia side and from the Ugandan side, and I hope they kind of kind of say, hey, we've got this other thing. Let's try this too, instead of just sticking to the traditional stuff as well. But it's going to be like kind of like nothing else, no matter what.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything else like that out there. And, you know, whether it works or it doesn't, you know, that's kind of the story. And I think something cool is going to come out of it.
Well, like, I mean, the closest thing I could think of is sort of two things. One is the Paul Simon's Graceland you talked about. But that was Paul Simon wanting to expose a new audience to African music, you know, like mm-hmm. Ladysmith Black Mambazo, if I'm saying that right. My apologies mm-hmm. if I didn't. Like, he wanted to bring that stuff that he listened to and heard and was like, oh, my God, no, you guys are going to love it. And he incorporated some good old-fashioned poppy stuff into it, so it was more palatable. But it's mm-hmm. it's not like anybody was telling Paul Simon what to do, and that's not a knock. He's just he's the guy. I mean, he earned yeah. that right. And then there was also, and I'm spacing on the name of it. U2 had a bunch of a plethora of African artists cover their songs in African style. But again, that's sort of like, this is what U2 would sound like if it came out of Africa. These are the closest things I can compare this to. And it's not a good comparison. Like, and what was the responses from the Appalachians and the Ugandans when you pitched this idea to them? Were they like, oh, this is great? Or were they like, oh my God, you're crazy and needed some convincing?
I thought everybody would be, you're crazy, like, you're crazy.
Yeah.
That was like the expected response, I think. That when I told everybody about this, that they would be like, what? That's too far-fetched. But everybody's been really like, wow, this is going to be kind of cool. And, you know, I've taken the West Virginians over, you know, none of the West Virginians have been to Africa that I'm taking. And, you know, the Ugandans have never met the ones that the people that I'm taking. They've met Ernest, the producer, and Mike, another producer who worked on their album before. But they're going to meet the subjects of the film for the first time, and you're going to have to kind of just get trial by fire kind of thing, get thrown into it, and see what happens.
Yeah, and even if there's conflict, you know, even if there's fighting. That's sort of, I mean, God almighty, what creative endeavor doesn't have some infighting and some creative differences of that regard?
Right.
You know, that's not even the end of the world. That's just sometimes part of the process.
I think definitely. I mean, all of the great kind of making of the album docs that are out there, and, you know, docs in general, or just stories in general, are just about people having challenges and overcoming them and working through them. And, you know, I can't wait to see how, you know, we've got great groups on both sides, and just to see how they kind of work through them and what the end result sounds like.
Now, just to also throw some credibility your way, John made a, now it's, am I right in calling it an award-winning documentary? You've collected some laurels with it.
Yeah, we premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival last year, and I think we went to about a dozen other ones.
Yeah, so it's called Surviving Cliffside, about your family in West Virginia. So tell us about that. And this is the reason why I bring it up is not only to promote it, go see Surviving Cliffside, but also just to throw out there. I mean, unfortunately, one of the downsides of the Kickstarter, you know, crowdfunding world is that unfortunately you do get I don't know what the exact number is, but sometimes you get some people who ask for a lot of money and don't deliver, or don't have the capability, or don't have the ability, and are dreaming and maybe just sometimes bite off a little bit more than they could chew. And I'm not trying to disparage anybody or anything, but we've all seen those projects. John is a guy who does make stuff. He's a guy that does deliver. And a really great example of that is the Surviving Cliffside documentary. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Surviving Cliffside takes place in a trailer park called Cliffside in my hometown of Alum Creek, West Virginia. And it stars my cousin. He's a young guy and lives in Cliffside. And he's got a 7-year-old daughter who beats leukemia and makes a run for Little Miss West Virginia. So it's about, you know, it chronicles her pageant run, but it's really about the world and the characters and you know, what they go through in this kind of unique environment down there.
And I know nothing about West Virginia. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I don't know anything. I've never been there. I've never driven through it. And I think what is, like, I don't know. It's interesting to hear that, like, a family, like a beauty, the beauty pageant circuit in West Virginia. A lot of people are going to approach that material with a certain amount of preconceived notions. Are they sort of correct? Like, what are your thoughts on that? Are they correct, or is there just like a whole other side to that sort of world that we kind of don't know about?
Well, I mean, I think Cliffside, for the most part, does – well, it does a little bit of both. It kind of embraces some of the stereotypes and shows why, you know, they might be better things than you think. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of turns some of them on their heads. And about West Virginia and about people that – you know, families that may enter these pageants and kids that may enter these pageants. And just the whole maybe – you know, it's – this is – you know, this is not like Honey Boo Boo, or, you know, and it's not like some of the Appalachian exploitation films that have come out. It's more, you know, it's my family, you know, and it's a more heartfelt kind of thing, and it's you know, it's not objective journalism by any means. Like, this is subjective. Oh, sure. Like, I go into it saying that this is my family and I love them, and you know, it comes out, and I still have to spend Thanksgiving and Christmas with them every year, so I want to make sure that they like it. But at the same time, you know, I want to show, you know, I'm not like showing a, you know, the rosiest picture of them that glosses over all the flaws either. I want to show them as complete people. I mean, I think that's how you reach an audience, is you get them to empathize, and that's how you move them, is to get them to be in your character's shoes. And the way to do that is to show that they're just like you. And, you know, that's what I was trying to do with Cliffside, is to show, yeah, you might not live in a trailer park known for its, like, guns and crime and drugs, and you might not be exposed to the things that they are every day, but, you know, you have the same, you know, at a basic human level, the same hopes and fears and dreams and anger and pride, and you love your family just like this family does. And, you know, the more you can relate to them, the more you're going to feel for what they go through.
No, absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And it's funny is everything you just talked about can also be applied. That's a great way to segue over to some of your screenwriting work. And you've been doing a lot of you're doing a lot of documentary, but John and I met actually at the Austin Film Festival, where we both had scripts. I'm trying to remember. I was a second rounder.
Yeah, I was second rounder.
You were second rounder too. Yeah. Okay, cool. I just want to make sure if you were a finalist or something. I didn't want to shortchange you. Uh-oh. And how has that sort of how have the two worlds of screenwriting and documentary, how have you been able to manage those two things? Because Well, anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We met at the Austin Film Festival, and what a great festival for writers. I mean, it's different than any that I've been to, focusing on writing. And I really appreciated that about it. I mean, as far as, like, documentaries go and how they're similar to writing, I mean, editing this documentary, I was a kind of a co-editor on it with Jennifer Ruff. Is a great editor and the head of editing at NYU's film school. But Jen and I worked on this, and it was the best really exercise in screenwriting that I had, was editing a documentary. Because you kind of have to really look at story and figure out all the same things you have to figure out with the screenplay is, you have all these scenes, you have the moments that you hope feel like real life, and I'm down there and I'm shooting, and I don't know, like, when to stop. So right. Jen and I kind of laid everything out on note cards, just like you would with the screenplay, and said, here are all of our scenes. Do we have a story here? Is there a beginning, middle, and an end? And or do we have to keep shooting? And we eventually found that we had a story. We had a film. And kind of did it the same way that you would the screenplay. When I was editing, I had these same kind of note cards laid out, and you know, to remember what the scenes are, because you kind of shoot a lot, just like you kind of like write a lot sometimes, and you write things that may be fluff or may not really further the story, and then you have to kind of you have to shear those away and get at what the heart of it is, and the same applies to screenwriting and to doc filmmaking.
Well, yeah. Well, unfortunately, with screenwriting, if you write for a week a bunch of fluff, it's only going to cost you, you know, writing. But with filming, that's a lot of money. So it's very smart to go in. It's so interesting you say that, because I totally agree with that. Like, all these things, whether it be documentary, filming, directing, writing, they're all spokes of the same wheel. But it's all story engineering. To a degree, and they all can help each other. I think, you know, been doing unscripted TV for so long, I think has actually helped me be judicious in my own deletions and my own sort of don't need that, don't need that, don't need that. Like, one of the executive producers I'm trying to get on the podcast, well, he is one of the most ruthless, and he was an editor, and he's one of the most ruthless shooters as far as, nope, that's it, done. Nope, that's it, done. He's like, no, I can see. He's like, no, we got it. I can see it. Once you have your story, after a while, you're just wasting tape, and it's a fascinating thing. I'm scheduled to have an editor on next week, knock on wood, and I'm going to bring this up again with her, because I think it is a fascinating thing, the editing and screenwriting process, like how editing applies to screenwriting. Mm-hmm. And now you've also been doing, let's touch upon this, you've been doing some commercial work.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's funny. I never really thought about doing commercials very much, and I was at South by Southwest last year with Cliffside and a commercial production company called Workhouse Creative. Keith Rivers over there saw the documentary and loved it, and asked me if I'd ever thought about doing commercials. And so since then, I've done, that was like a year ago, because South By is next week. So in this year, I've done 7 commercials, either on spec or for contest or for paid gigs during that time. And I really love them. I mean, they're like, I mean, what the things I do are like little stories. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, really, you know, some of them are tearjerkers and some of them are just kind of like sweet kind of emotional moments, all kind of, not all doc style, but all kind of like the authentic kind of emotional style that all my favorite commercials are. So that's what I've been kind of focusing a lot on that in the past year. And it's really fun. I mean, you kind of do them and then they're done and over with, you know, within a month or so, and you move on to the next thing. So it's kind of nice after coming, you know, out of a doc that takes, you know, so long to do and to produce or anything, to go to something that moves on really quickly.
It's interesting, because I think like 10, 15 years ago, and even though like Ridley Scott made commercials, and I think Phil Jono, I don't know if I'm getting, I know a lot of your favorite movie directors out there, listener, have made commercials.
Yeah.
But like 10, 15 years ago, like commercials was even lower than TV. You know, remember when like, oh, you don't want to write TV.
Right.
You don't want to direct TV. That's beneath all of us. And all that. There was a real highbrow sort of snobbery toward the world of commercials and television. But I think with the era of TiVo and DirecTV, or excuse me, like the DVR rather, and of course the Super Bowl has always been the sort of Oscars for commercials. But like nowadays, like, and I find this is a dinner party conversation or out at the bar with friends, and people like, I go to fast forward through the commercials, but I end up watching them because I'm like, oh, I love this whatever it is ad, you know, or oh my god, and it seems to be there's a, I don't know if you've seen any of this in the industry of, I'm not involved in commercialism at all or the commercial making. Is there a sense of like, look, we don't want people to fast forward through them, so these have to be good.
Yeah,
you know, is there a vibe like that going through the business?
I think that's totally right. I don't know if I've thought about it as much as you have about that, but I think that's that hits the nail on the head. I mean, you really can kind of limit yourself from watching any kind of commercial if you try and not really try that hard. But so you know, you do have to have that something worth watching. And, you know, I think you're seeing that more. I mean, like, you know, Nicholas Winding Refn, who did Drive, and he's doing the Matthew McConaughey Lincoln MKZ commercials, and, you know, like, doing commercials in a way that I think are really cool. And of course, you get the Apple commercial that came out last December with the granddaughter and grandmother, and she's making the song for her on the Apple product. And just, I mean, commercials like that aren't your Super Bowl commercials, that are just like, that have to be better, and the bar is raising. I mean, I think because you said that people can choose to watch them or not, and they want to make these commercials that, you know, aren't just the things that you see, you know, you catch on TV randomly, but are things that people, you know, share on social media, you know, that they're like, you know, not just a thing that you'll see on TV and say, oh, that's nice, but things that you'll like take kind of ownership in and say like, oh, this is something I like and this speaks to me, and you'll share it with your friends.
Well, not that I'm endorsing any particular product, but look at like Flo from Progressive. You know what I mean? She's now a TV character. She's a proper character on TV.
Right.
And it's funny, the only reason why I sort of bring it up like that is because I've heard people just talk about commercials almost in the way they talk about shows. And I can't help but wonder. Now, I know you're on the indie scene, and you know, I'm writing an indie movie and talking to indie producers. Now, the money there is manageable. But I think in the world of even small studio pictures, movies are just so freaking expensive these days. I wonder if a lot of filmmakers now are like, look, I'm going to make some commercials because that's where the weight of the world isn't on my shoulders, and I can experiment and I can try new things, and it's not going to be $50 million on the line, you know, and it's just a good place to hone your craft.
Oh, I think so, definitely. I mean, being able to tell a story in 30 or 60 seconds and to move somebody emotionally in that period of time, I mean, and that's what you're doing too. I mean, whether you're making art, you know, and or a commercial, I mean, you're trying to move people. I mean, that's the purpose of it. And it's either, you know, as an end in itself, or it's to sell a product, you know, and to connect that emotion with the brand. But it's the same skill, you know, it's the same skill no matter what the end goal is. So I think to be able to do that in a really short period of time is just like great, great, great training as a writer and as a director, as a filmmaker in general.
So let's, I want to not stray too much far away from Psalms. Is your mission, because now, I mean, we could, you know, you've been a screenwriter, documentarian, filmmaker, is, and with Surviving Cliffside, and now with incorporating this Appalachian Jewish group, I mean, I don't want to say mission, but like, you know, West Virginia is obviously very close to your heart, and that's something that, like, are you on a mission to promote sort of another side of where you come from and show people different aspects of it?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm on a mission, but I'll accept it if I'm not. Like, I like the idea of you know, of showing different sides of West Virginia, and you know like, so in this, you know, in this documentary, we've got one of our subjects is named Mike Pushkin, and Mike is a really interesting character, and maybe not your stereotypical person or West Virginian at all. I mean, he's grew up, you know, in synagogue. He's Jewish, and I met him. I played open mic at an open mic that he hosted. He's a musician, and he also drives a taxi cab. He's the only he was the only taxi cab driver that would drive on Christmas, since he's Jewish in West Virginia. So he's doing that, and he also just got elected to the state house of delegates, so he's a politician and he's a lawmaker now. So he's a Jewish Appalachian Jewish musician, cab driver, politician. So yeah, tell Megan that one too.
Yeah, God Almighty. So I mean, it's just, I'm just sort of want to speak to the reason why I brought up that question is like, there's always that phrase, write what you know, write what you know. And I think that's kind of a misnomer, and it's can sometimes be a trap. You know, I've been watching the TV show Doctor Who for 30 years. The hardest thing in the world I can do is write a Doctor Who spec. Mm-hmm. But it, we're really, what when people say write what you know, what they mean is really write write about the world, the philosophies, and the place that you come from. And I think West Virginia is just a good example, because I think a lot of people have a certain image in their mind, and it may not be accurate. And something like Psalms and that story you just told about the, I'm not even going to list it off, the Jewish cab driving politician. I mean, that is a very eye-opening thing. And is that something that is also percolating or you're exploring in your screenwriting?
Yeah, I mean, writing, it's really interesting you say this, Tim, and I'm interested to hear what you were saying too about the whole write what you know thing. Because in film school, I think I had some success doing some really personal stories that were very autobiographical and very much just myself and heart poured out onto the page and screen. And I kind of was very afraid to get away from that, because I thought, well, if I don't tell something that's just totally just pouring my heart out me, then it's not going to be good. And I've kind of found that it's write what you know, which kind of means write who you are. You know, write something that's authentic to you, and that doesn't have to be like an autobiographical thing. But I teach the class I teach at Columbia College Hollywood is called Finding Your Voice. It's a creative writing class, and I always thought when I was younger, it's like finding your voice. That means like you have to go out and find it somewhere. Like it's somewhere else. Like it's in this writer that you like or that writer that you like, and you combine all these together and that's you. But it's actually like your voice is you, is like your actual physical voice and your physical like and your thoughts, and like that's who you are, is like what makes you unique. And I mean, even like Martin Scorsese talks about like he is as a director, like how he moves the camera is the way like he physically sees the world in these like kind of quick movements, and he talks really fast, and you know, like just thinking of like writing and filmmaking and making art in general is it being like who you are, you know, I think is really what hits home to me about like write what you know.
I can't agree with you more. And I, like, you know, it's like if you are not, if you went and wrote a bank robbery movie and then I went and wrote a bank robbery movie, they would be two totally different movies.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and we would each be bringing to it our own various philosophies and things. And I the finding your voice thing is fascinating. I feel like I've been writing screenplays since I wrote my first script in 1991. I don't even remember. And like I'm still finding my voice. And
yeah.
I always feel like that can also be a scary thing for aspiring writers or writers who are listening to this who aren't as experienced as John and I. Don't panic. It's a process. You know what I mean? You're going to have to sometimes, I wrote two scripts last year that were, I felt about as confident, as comfortable as I ever did. And it's one of those things where it sometimes just takes a while in finding that. I think you're absolutely right to say it is what is unique to you. What is the thing that I think too often, I'm getting a little wordy here, but too often, I made this mistake, like we aspire to write something that's like, well, I better deliver what they want, whereas not realizing that what they actually want is what only I can give them, and I can't think about what they want. I have to write in such a way where it's like, look, this is my story, the Scorsese example is great, this is how I see the world, and here's my script, take it or leave it. You know,
yeah, I love that.
You know, I think that's an honest mistake that or sort of, and I think you're right about, or it's an honest insecurity that a lot of us have. And what sort of advice would you have for somebody who said, and I know this is a big part of your course, but like if somebody said, a screenwriter emails you and says, John, I can't find my voice. I don't know what that means. I don't have a voice. What do I do?
I think it's all about figuring out who you are, you know.
Yeah.
And I think Tim, like I love that you're honest. I'm still figuring that out. I think anybody that's honest is still figuring that out. I would, trust somebody that says that much more than someone that says, "Oh, I'm self-actualized. I've figured it all out." Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But
walk away slowly.
It's all about figuring out who you are, and what that means is like, I think like really figuring out what your tastes are is part of that. You know, like, I mean, no, like what you really like and what, like for me, for example, like, yeah, I like some cool shit. Like, I like some cool, like, movies and films that are like art house, like, you know, new wave. Like, my film professors would think that's, that I'm, you know, that I'm knowledgeable, but I also like really cheesy stuff too. Like, that's me. That I like this range of, like, you know, I'll listen to like indie music, then I'll listen to like soft rock, Huey Lewis and the News. Like, that's like me. Like, I have a, this blend of this, of different tastes that, you know, that, and, you know, I think it's like breaking out of like, oh, I should like this because this person thinks this, or I should write this certain way because some, this person will think it's cool, or this will sell, or like, you know, you're saying like, this is what they want, and really saying like, this is what I like, and this is who's me, and this is what makes me excited to write or to make movies, or, you know, this is what excites me, and this is the kind of thing I want to read, and like finding that, and like, if you're, if you can follow that and be excited about what you're writing and like get pleasure out of it, of the art that you're making as you're making it, and when you revisit it, have that same kind of pleasure as like, this is me, then, I mean, it's, that's what it's all about. And that's, you know, that's how you do what is you.
Oh, amen, brother. Amen. I mean, I remember my freshman year getting like, God almighty, some of them, not all of them, but some of my fellow film students were like, oh, you like John Carpenter? Oh, he's like the worst filmmaker. And I'm like, oh. Yeah. What are you talking about? And even now, more than ever, I absolutely, because I remember like, okay, I'm going to watch Halloween and like Big Trouble Little China and Escape from New York. And even like The Thing on DVD, I try to watch like once a year because that is just a brilliant claustrophobic. And I'm like, no, not only do I like John Carpenter, I still like John Carpenter. And he's a lot better than a lot of people think. And I think that's absolutely right, because if you look up, I just want to defend John Carpenter for a second, but I think if you look up, just to add to your point, if you were to those of you listening to this, like, look up your favorite filmmakers or favorite screenwriters, look up some of their interviews and quotes, and I bet you will not see any of them say, well, I created this because everybody else was doing it this way. You know what I mean? Like, they're all influenced by people, and we're all sort of remaking our favorite movies. You know, like, I think I have, like, a Casablanca reference in every script I write. But, like, it's still, you've got to come up with an original thing and do it your way, because that's the only way you're going to stand out from the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and looking at what you're doing now. So, let's see, we're coming up on time. Let's full circle this. Let's talk some more about Psalms. You guys have not shot this yet. You're raising money to shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're offering all kinds of stuff here on the Kickstarter. I don't know if you want to talk about some of those prizes and things like that.
Oh, yeah, totally. Oh, man. These rewards are so cool. Like, I didn't even think they were going to be this cool. But I got Dan Davis from Kinship Goods in West Virginia. You know, I had to get a West Virginia person to help us with titles and graphic design and designing all of our merch. And he designed our T-shirts and tote bags. And this place, if you've never heard of it, you've probably seen people wear this stuff. It's like really big on Etsy. It's called Kinship Goods, and you can look that up on the internet. Kin, like K-I-N, and they like the Mindy Project. They've wore it. They've I'm trying to think of who all's wore it on TV. But you'll see this stuff and you'll be like, oh, that's really cool. Where did they get that shirt? And it's gotten really big that way. So we've got a T-shirt designed by Dan at Kinship Goods, and we've got a tote bag designed by Dan. Dan did all of our logos and titles, and then we've got a lot of great music. We've got music. The album, when it comes out, we've got music right now of the album that was produced there 2 years ago in Uganda. We've got music from the West Virginia, West Virginians in the dock. We've got, let's see what else. We've got a music lesson from one of them, a songwriting lesson. We've got associate producer and producer credits. We've got like a thing where we're going to Skype in backers to do like a real time behind the scenes, so you can see us actually making the album while it's happening. So I don't know. We tried to – these are really – we worked really hard to try to get really cool incentives and rewards. So we hope people like them. We hope that's kind of incentive for folks to back our project.
Well, you know, there's a real lesson in here about crowdfunding and also just networking in general, which is like you guys are offering something for the investment. And that's a really important thing. And, you know, like Veronica Mars was one of the real big Kickstarters, you know, by a major company and stuff. And people, it raised a lot of eyebrows what Veronica Mars did, because the audience who supported Veronica Mars said, look, we are going to pay X amount of dollars for this product. And we're talking a lot about creativity and the independent scene and all this stuff. But look, there's still money. You know, you got to buy cameras. You got to buy editing equipment. We're all trying to make a living. We want to eat food tomorrow with these off of these movies, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a business aspect to this too. So if you're out there and you're thinking about kickstarting and crowdfunding and stuff, and you know, Shannon and Shalice were very much in touch with this on Penumbra, who I had on ages ago, but and who are doing amazing things still. Like, if you want people to invest in your Kickstarter, you have to offer them something for their investment. And I think you guys are doing a phenomenal job with that, with the album, with the film, with the songwriting lesson. Because I see a fair amount of Kickstarters, and some people email me on Twitter and say, hey, can you throw a plug out for this? Can you plug out that? And sometimes I will, and sometimes I won't, because sometimes I'm like, you're just asking people to give you money for your movie. Mm-hmm. And that's not really going to do it. Like, this whole venture that I'm doing here with this podcast, I'm not making a dollar, but people are donating their time to help give me content, and I'd like to donate promotion and exposure in return. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how networking works. You know, if a writer goes out to lunch with you and gives you a lot of advice and gives you a lot of tidbits and mentoring, you buy that lunch. You're not splitting it. You're buying it. You know, you're buying those drinks. If you know, and that's something that a lot of people need to be sort of reminded about in this world of networking and stuff. And just don't expect people to just give you stuff. There is a sort of give and take to all this. A little bit less cynically, John and I met at the Austin Film Festival, and it was literally because you just said hi to me. And you're like, hey, man, you walking back to the Driscoll? We were walking out of a round table. And I said, yeah, sure. And we just walked back together, started shooting the breeze. And next thing you know, we're spending hanging out the whole weekend, drinking beers, talking movies, writing, and all kinds of things.
Yeah, and Tim, if you ever write a book on networking, I will be the first in line to buy it and get a autograph copy, because I think you're the best I know of.
Oh, geez, I don't know what to say about it. Well, gosh, what a compliment. Well, I'm not very shy. I had to get over a fair amount of shyness, believe it or not. And then I'm like, oh, what the hell? Just start talking to people. What else did we miss about Psalms? What else do you want to say about it? The floor is yours, my friend.
Well, I mean, I think we're doing pretty good on our Kickstarter so far. If, you know, people want to go and check it out. And, you know, the thing is with that is we've got levels that are like at a dollar. So if you want to get our first single, you can donate a dollar. And what I really like about that is like of course we want to reach our goal, but what I would love is if we reach our goal and like the average, we had the lowest like average backer number there was, you know, like if we had, you know, a huge amount of backers that gave like a really small amount, that would make me really happy. And, you know, that's why I'm kind of like, it's this strength in numbers kind of thing, and just trying to get everybody to just give a really small amount. And the more people would get behind it, that's the more, you know, that's not just like the numbers as far as, like dollars go, because, you know, we're going to raise money outside of the Kickstarter for the film, but, you know, it's also the people that are kind of like a part of the project and a part of like the energy that's going behind it. So it's like, it's not just dollars, but it's like, hey, like, you are all like part of the team now. So if you give a dollar, you're part of the team. If you give $1,000, you're part of the team. It doesn't matter. Like, it's just, it's all people and it's all energy that's sending our way. That's going to get us there. And it's going to make the film as the best it could possibly be.
And I think that's a really fantastic point, because I think sometimes, you know, you see a friend post a Kickstarter on social media, like, oh God, they're asking for 15, 20, 20, 50 bucks. And we all have a budget. We're all living. You know what I mean? We all have to manage our money. And I think that's a great point. Like, sometimes when you see some of these Kickstarters and it's a project you really believe in, it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to break your bank.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is about that dollar or $5 goes a long way. And it, you know, there are great, great movies out there. And sometimes you got to look for them a little bit. And sometimes we've got to promote them a little bit extra on Twitter and Facebook. But if you're tired of what you're seeing on the marquee, don't worry. This is I feel like we're entering or within a golden age of independent cinema.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you could have made this 10 years ago, John.
Right. I think you're right.
You know, and to be able to reach out to people to do this. Anyway, John Matthews, and we didn't even talk about your movie. You got to direct James Franco and Whoopi Goldberg in a movie, by the way. Like, we didn't even get to that.
Yeah, it's called Black Dog, Red Dog, and it's going to be out in festivals this year. It stars Whoopi and James Franco and Olivia Wilde, and Logan Marshall Green is the star, the big star of the whole thing. And it was a great experience. I got to do while I was in James Franco's class at NYU, and he was really good to me and to the other students in his class. And I mean, I got to direct an Oscar winner while I was still in film school, so it was an amazing experience.
That's amazing. I've heard a lot of really – I've not met Mr. Franco, but I've heard a lot of really cool things about him and that sense of just – he's so open to art and artwork and all that kind of great stuff. Can I ask you one last question about that?
Yeah, sure.
Because I'm actually trying to work on a blog, a future blog. I'm trying to come, you know, I'm wrestling with the concept right now. But one of the things that, you know, I've had to go through in working with and meeting various celebrities is the separation of going from a fan to a pro. And what sort of, what was it like for you to be like, you know, walking on a set and being like, wow, holy shit, there's James Franco and Whoopi Goldberg and all that. But then you also have to just get on with it and direct the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just sit there and be like, no, have your autograph. You're going to be like, okay, no, I need you to do this. I need you to do that. And let's make this thing together.
Yeah. Oh, man. I was so nervous. I mean, me and Whoopi and Olivia Wilde. I mean, it was just like, I was like thinking ahead of time. I'm like, okay, what am I going to talk to them about? What am I going to talk to them about? But really, like, when you get down to it, like, they're just actors that, you know, that are trying to figure out the movie just like any other actors that are trying to figure out, like, and they want, and you're the person who knows the script and the film better than anyone else on set, so they're going to go to you because you're the director and be like, okay, what am I doing here? And it's the same kind of dynamics you would have on any set, even if you're dealing with an Oscar winner and you're a film student, because they want to look the best they can possibly look and have their best performance they can possibly have, so they're going to look to you for guidance. So you know, I think it just quickly just became like the starstruckness wore off, and it was just like any other set where you're just, you know, trying to both figure out the best way possible to make this movie.
Outstanding. That's a great note to end on. So anyway, Psalms is the making of an album. Is on Kickstarter now. Please consider going and donating a dollar or whatever you think, any one of these great awards and prizes. And you know something, and even if you can't donate, and I've said this before with other projects we've had on, if you can't donate, if you're like, you know something, no, I don't give to Kickstarters, I don't want to donate, tell you what, please consider throwing out a tweet, throw out a Facebook post, throw out something, get the word out. If you're on Stage 32, throw out a post that says, hey, you know something, check out this great feature, because somebody else out there may see this and be like, oh my God, I'm totally going to give that guy $500. So even just spreading the word, quite frankly, is super helpful. And this is going to be a great movie. This is going to be a super, super cool thing. I have no doubt that we're all going to love this and be just fascinated by it. So, John, congratulations. I'm wishing you all the best and can't wait to see it.
Thanks, Tim. I really appreciate you having me on here.
Oh, my pleasure, man. So anyway, thank you very much, and thank you guys for listening, downloading, retweeting. Help spread the word for Psalms and other great movies, other great independent projects to see out there. And we got lots of other great independent artists and filmmakers coming up for the next few weeks. Thanks for listening. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.